that glow. I asked the half-blind scholars which way the current goes. So cast your nets below. In the gods of the moving waters will tell us all they know. Circles of the planets, the circles of the moon, the circles of the atoms, all play a marching tune. And we who would join me stand aside no longer.
Good evening and happy Halloween. This is the Sanctuary Forest Radio Hour, and I'm Tasha McKee. I'm the Executive Director of Sanctuary Forest, hosting this show, and I'm really pleased to have Dana Stoltzman, Director of Salmonid Restoration Federation, here in the studio. And we also have Mark Lancaster from the Five Counties Salmonid Conservation Program on the line, I believe. Are you there, Mark?
Hi, good afternoon. Good evening.
Hi. I'm so glad you could join us tonight. We're going to be talking about water, which is probably no surprise to people that hear me on the radio. But guess what? We're not going to talk about ponds tonight and johads and groundwater recharge and all that great stuff. And we have very great results going on the Mattole right now, and it's a very important part of restoring our stream flows. But we wanted to dedicate the whole hour to helping people with their water for water security, and also so they're not diverting so much water in times of water scarcity that there's not water downstream. So when you listen to us, don't get stuck on thinking that we don't know that it's bigger than just human use. We do know that, but we're just going to focus on human use tonight because there's a lot that needs to be done in that arena, and we have people here to share that with us. So I'm going to start out with just a brief grounding in the Mattole, because Dana's work in Redwood Creek really started or stemmed a lot from that. And then, Mark, we'll bring you in as well. So most people have heard that in the Mattole we have a storage and forbearance program, Sanctuary Forests, developed with Department of Fish and Wildlife and State Water Resource Control Board and the community. And it's a very successful program, and it's taken a long time. We started in 2005. It's 2013 now, and we're very excited to say that between the 18 people in our program and another estimated 22, making 40 people for 40 households for bearing, that's about 30% of the whole watershed, of the households in the whole watershed. But it's taken about 8 years. And when we look at water scarcity in all over the state and on these coastal streams, and with Mark being able to talk about the five counties, we'll really get a big picture of that. We really need to be able to address this water scarcity problem on a bigger scale and faster and reach more people. There's a lot of people that can't afford to do it on their own, and there needs to be at the very least, there needs to be support, more county and state support for that. So just briefly, just to kind of tell you a little bit more about where we are in the Mattole, what we accomplished in those 8 years, 18 landowners with 1 million gallons of water installed, costing with public funding that was put into this project, $1.8 million. And the landowners also contribute. I don't have what that number is right now, but it varies anywhere from $2,000 to $10,000 per landowner dollars. In terms of what the benefit we got out of that, if you look at the pumping rate for each landowner, they were about 10 gallons a minute. And if everybody had their pump on at once, 18 times 10 is 180 gallons per minute. And that's a lot, and that's enough to dry up the river in the low, where we are, because we're in the headwaters, in the low flow time. They probably wouldn't all be on at once. More likely a third of them would be on at once, and that's still 60 gallons a minute. And our flows get down to less than 40 gallons a minute just because of land use impacts and climate change without human use. So you can see that this is significant. And we are very grateful for all the funders that have helped and everybody that's in that program. And we're looking at, okay, if we want to move this to other watersheds, what's that challenge? And I'm going to pass it on to Dana now, because on Redwood Creek, you have a bigger population and some different issues, and we're going into a time with less funding available.
Absolutely. So for years, as a Redwood Creek resident and as someone who also runs a small nonprofit grassroots organization, I looked to the Mattol Project and thought, wow, how could we emulate this in another watershed? And Redwood Creek is a 26-square-mile watershed that borders the Mattol and flows into the South Fork of the Eel River. And why we felt like Redwood Creek was so significant was that there are at least 5 tributaries that flow into Redwood Creek, and all of them are pretty densely populated for our rural area. And all of these tributaries have historically supported coho salmon, chinook, and steelhead. So this was, you know, and still is, really vital rearing habitat for threatened species like the coho salmon. And when we started to compare and explore the feasibility of transferring the Mattol's successful forbearance program to Redwood Creek, we started seeing some truly fundamental differences between water usage within the watersheds and some kind of geologic and hydrologic differences. One of the main ones is that Redwood Creek is fed by a lot of springs. So instead of people directly pumping out of the creek, people are utilizing the springs on their land throughout the year. And one of the things that we did in the effort to use the fantastic pilot project that Sanctuary Forest has is that we sent out a landowner survey. We tried to get it to as many people in the watershed as possible. There's about 400 landowners within Redwood Creek, but many more residents. And we were trying to understand how people valued Redwood Creek. Was it, you know, for their irrigation? Was it for clean water? Was it for its aesthetic beauty? Was it for the value of salmon habitat? And we got a really great response rate. But one of the things that became apparent was that there was, as I said, a lot more direct dependence on springs.
And that's important. And Mark, maybe you could chime in on this part about pumping rates and whether you're pumping out of a creek or if you're coming out of a spring, and the rate of how you take the water matters. Could you speak to that?
Well, sure, although I'd be happy to let Dana clarify if I don't get
okay.
it very well. I mean, one of the things that we've looked at is the timing of the pumping and the day and nighttime fluctuations of water in the channels. And so with a spring, at least you have a constant flow, where you're pumping directly out of a creek. During the day, the flow in those creeks generally goes down as the evapotranspiration rate of trees increases. And so if you have people pumping during the time when the creek is already in its lowest flow cycle because the trees are pumping the water out, then you can get stranding, you can get temperature increases, you can get stratification of the water temperatures. And with the springs, at least you have the constant flow, so you have a little bit more opportunity, if you will, a little more flexibility to control the effect of the timing on it. So when you're pumping directly out of the creek, you have a responsibility to be way more aware of what's going on overall, plus you don't know exactly who all is pumping at the same time. I'm not sure that got to what you were asking.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. And then the other math that I've done is, if you look at how much water a family uses in a day, and let's just use 1,000, actually we were using 900 gallons a day for a family with a small garden and about 3 people. If you average that over a 24-hour day, I think you get a little less than a gallon a minute. Like it's about 0.6 gallons a minute or something. If you compare that, so if that's coming out of a spring, it's trickling in all the time. It's most of the water from the spring should still be going down into the watershed, and you're just taking the small part. And that's really different than pumping at a rate of 10 gallons a minute, more than 10 times as much out of a water body. So there, you can also use slow pumps. If you don't have a spring, you can also use slow pumps. So one of the things that we'll be talking tonight about is things, other things people can do that really help a lot that are not so capital intensive. And this is one of them, is having, and I think, were you, Mark, did you have some stuff on wells too? I mean, we're not very successful with wells around here, but for places that are, can you speak to water use from wells?
Well, the wells that have the biggest effect, and you see this a lot, is people will put a well adjacent to a creek. They'll call it a well. They think they're pumping out of groundwater, but actually, in a lot of cases, all they're doing is pumping the interstitial flow, which is actually part of the surface flow. So the area that we look at relative to wells is almost identical to looking at surface pumping. If your well is relatively shallow, you just need to be aware, are you actually pumping interstitial surface flow, or are you actually tapping down into the deeper waters? I do kind of want to back up. One of the things that we've been trying to emphasize, if you're a surface stream flow diverter, is the use of very small pipe systems to trickle fill a water tank that is located outside of the actual channel, and then pump your water out of that tank rather than directly out of the creek. So like you were saying, Tasha, 10 or 5 gallons a minute out of the creek can be substantial, but 10, 15 gallons out of a tank that is slowly trickle recharging in the stream system is almost negligible to the stream flow itself.
You know, I wanted to bring up a point, because a lot of times it's hard for people to visualize the scale that we're talking about. And one of the things, SRF was able to conduct a low flow study this summer with Eel River Salmon Restoration Project, Bill Eastwood, who's a known restorationist and geologist. And we basically, you know, had to start the low flow study a little earlier than we anticipated, given that this was such a low flow crisis year. But even the monitoring sites that had the strongest flow back in July, the most, we weren't even able to measure cubic feet per second. We were measuring gallons per minute. And the highest flows were at about 45 gallons per minute. And within 2 or 3 weeks, by, you know, mid-August, most of the flows were below 1 gallon a minute. So you can imagine that even at a conservative pumping rate, how quickly one can dewater the stream. And we were seeing the pools drying up that had juvenile coho salmon. So it doesn't take that much water usage in that critical time, those dry summer months, since we live in a Mediterranean climate, to basically be isolating, you know, pools where that are habitat for endangered species. And one of the fascinating things, because we had some early rains in September and a substantial rain, was that we're trying to understand, we continued the monitoring to understand what level of additional flow was required to connect those pools. And hopefully that will be really useful information, because in order to be able to participate in a grant program or come up with a water conservation strategy that would really fit Redwood Creek, you really have to look at, you know, all the factors and variables and understand, you know, the given hydrology of the areas, and to be able to estimate what amount of conservation would really make a difference. And it's important to remember that we all live here, we're all using water, so it's kind of how do we collectively address the cumulative impacts. And one of the things I've been wondering about is that the Sanctuary Forest Program, there were many mechanisms in place in order for landowners to participate in the program. They had to forbear, and also there was, you know, some coordinated information. It was part of monitoring. So what I'm really interested in is, what can we do to encourage people to want to forbear? Because what we've noticed in the outreach in Redwood Creek is that a lot of people are doing the right thing. They are investing in water storage. They didn't necessarily, you know, have any grant funding to do that. And how do we make this next step of, you know, having our tanks, having the water that we need for the year, and for the worst case scenario, not the best case scenario, but, you know, a dry year or fire protection, how do we start to voluntarily forbear without the, you know, structure of a government-funded program?
Great. Okay, well, let's go to Mark now. Mark, we didn't have you give a bigger picture of what you're doing with the five counties and the water conservation, what kind of support and research or projects you're doing. So why don't we give you a chance to talk a little bit about the big picture there?
Okay. Well, the five counties program, it, It encompasses projects in Humboldt, Del Norte, Mendocino, Trinity, and Siskiyou counties. So it's a big area. It's coastal. It's interior, and the work has principally been around fish passage, fish migration, and road sediment reduction. But it has a couple of other key components. One is a training and education and best management practices program for county road departments and planners. And the goals there are to modify behavior in small ways, but get as big of a return for the benefit of the watershed as you can. And so what we found is just by training people how to think slightly different, how to do things slightly different, we can do it at a very low cost and we can get a very positive outcome. So that's another key component of what we do. But we've spent about $25 million doing fish passage habitat restoration projects over the last 15 years, and what we've noticed is that in the end, there has been some significant climatic variation where about one out of every 3 years we're in an extremely dry weather cycle, and about one every 3 to 4 years we're in a very wet weather cycle, and the stresses of these are so great that we actually realized we need to shift our program and focus as much on water quantity and water quality, mostly water quantity now, as we do on passage and habitat restoration. So we've undertaken a series of water conservation education efforts here in the interior in Trinity County. We've really emphasized the timing of water diversions, the use, again, of trickle systems that do not pump directly out of streams. We've emphasized rooftop rainwater collection systems, xeric landscaping. But as part of that, one of the things we realize is that California is not watershed friendly to landowners. California kind of relies on regulation to achieve its objectives to protect public trust resources like fish and habitat. And we all compete for dollars. In fact, all three of us are nonprofit organizations, and ironically, sometimes we work together, and sometimes we're competing with each other for the very limited dollar pool. And one of the things that we began to realize is that we simply need to rethink how we're doing things in this state and to incentivize landowners to be able to do conservation. So one of the things that we've tried to point out is that if you're a landowner in California today, or actually in the United States today, and you want to replace your old windows with new high-efficient energy windows, we're going to give you a tax credit. Or if you want to install solar panels on your house for your benefit, we're going to give you a tax credit because those are public trust resources that you're dealing with. You're reducing energy demand. You're reducing carbon emissions. But there's nothing in California that incentivizes people to protect habitats. So one of the areas that we're looking at is let's change the way we do this. Instead of just relying on regulation, let's find a way to make water tanks, to make trickle water tank systems work, to make forbearance a benefit to people, to even maintain habitats through new zoning approaches that would keep longer rotation forests and stream setbacks and things like that. I don't want to get too far off of what we're talking about.
No, this is great.
But I think that the thing that we've seen is that grant funds are cyclical at best. They tend to be the lowest during the most economically depressed times, which is also the time when you tend to have the greatest pressure to reduce cost on protection resources. So if we can get out of having to be grant junkies and get into being able to have a stable, reliable tax base approach, and there's a number of changes we can make in California that are, let's use the geeky terms, revenue neutral. We can move money from a few existing state programs to incentivize habitat restoration, to incentivize water conservation, and to make these public trust resources more available throughout the community. Now, there's certain groups of water users that are not even aware of this, are not going to participate. But it's like Dana said, you know, it's a cumulative effects process. And if we can reach 10 or 20% of the people, because they simply want to do better, and there's a motivator there for them to do better, that's actually going to be fairly significant.
Yeah. Great. Well, I want to just tell our listeners who we are again and let everybody know that we will have a call-in time starting at 7:45. And at that time, you can call in at 923-3911 with questions for any of us. This is the Sanctuary Forest Radio Hour with Tasha McKee from Sanctuary Forest, Dana Stoltzman from Salmonid Restoration Federation, and Mark Lancaster from the Five Counties Salmonid Conservation Program. And Mark, going back to a couple of points that you were talking about, one of the things that we're so excited about in the Mattole is culture change, and I think that that's probably the biggest benefit we've gotten out of doing this storage and forbearance program. And for people that don't know what forbear means, it's we're using that word a lot tonight. It basically means not exercising your right to take the water from the stream or the spring. If you have water rights, then it's forbearing from exercising them and using stored water instead. So in speaking about culture change, I just want to tell a story that just incredibly warmed our hearts. So we were very excited to work with the Southern Humboldt Unified School District, and we put in 80,000 gallons of storage for the Whitethorn School, and just recently had a kind of a little ceremony with the signs, all the students holding the signs and getting their photograph taken. And they were asked about water and about the fish, and they knew that there's salmon in the Mattole. They absolutely knew that this was what it was all about. And there's 80 students there. And one little girl said that when she needs a drink of water, she only fills her glass as full as what she's going to drink because she doesn't want to waste any of that water because the fish need it. It practically brings tears to my eyes. I mean, it's just like, what more could you ask for in terms of consciousness raising? And I think that you're right, that you don't need to necessarily try to reach everybody, that if you can reach especially, you know, education, like schools and things like that, and you can start getting enough people in the community and then do things like we have this sign that we keep up that shows what the river level is, and that doesn't actually cost very much for us to just monitor this one spot on the river and update that sign every week. And then the whole community knows what the water level is. And so then really what we need to do, though, now if people get excited and they say, oh, well, I want to do this too and I want to do it on my own, is these obstacles that you're talking about, Mark. And I wanted to bring up some work that Estelle Fennell and Rex Bone, our supervisors, two of our Humboldt County supervisors, are starting on with an ad hoc committee to deal with some of these obstacles. And just to take the property tax issue, because we've talked about that before, but I want to bring up a couple of things that Estelle researched that she discussed at this meeting. So she started looking at what other counties are doing and started reading up on property tax that's based on increasing the value of your property by doing anything, like putting a tank, in this case, putting a tank in, though. And there was two ways that she thought that maybe the county could exempt the storage tanks from property taxes. One was that if something's required by the state, then you can't be taxed for putting it in. And it was great because Jane Arnold got up, and she's our water rights person, our habitat resource person out of Department of Fish and Wildlife and Eureka office, and she said, this is absolutely correct, in terms of that it is required by the state. In any places where there's low flows where they think someone diverting is going to be a substantial use, it will be required by the state of California that you forbear from pumping during these low flow times. And so, therefore, under that language that Estelle had found, and I'm not sure what where she found it, but that it would apply. So that was one. And then the other was that if you're decreasing, this was from Sonoma County, if you're having something put on your deed, like a forbearance agreement, where you're agreeing to not pump during certain seasons, that reduces the value of your property, or at least your ability to sell it quickly. And so you could argue that the increase in value from the tank is equal to the decrease in value of the forbearance. So there's a whole bunch of other things. Do you have any, have you done any thinking about the property tax issue, and Mark, and ways to get counties to make that exempt? Because that's the first thing that hits people when they do it on their own here.
In fact, I'm actually surprised that Humboldt County Assessor would actually try to to tax the water tanks, because this is something that has come up numerous times in the past. And my limited work with assessors is that they are not taxing the tanks if they're for these purposes. If they're, for instance, if rooftop rainwater tanks are not taxed.
No, it's incredible. Like, we're, you know, even the tanks in our program are we retain ownership of them for 15 years, and we are depreciating them. And just recently, the Humboldt County tax assessors decided that they need to come out and look at these tanks and get them on their books, because, you know, when that 15 years is up, they want to see if there's a nickel left for them. It's just I just think it's outrageous. Well, but at any rate, we're trying to work with them and not get into head knocking, because it never works.
It actually goes to another component of one of the projects that we're talking about, and I'm going to go real deep here real quick.
Okay, good.
The very first laws known to man, and this is the essentially we call it the public trust doctrine, but it's reflected in the Magna Carta. Somehow didn't make it into our Constitution too much, but the first laws known to man were actually that the game and the water belongs to the people. And that has actually ironically been reflected through most cultures through time. And the funny thing about our tax system is that we do not treat these public resources, these public trusts, as public trusts when it lands on private property. We treat it as if it's a private value, and we tax it substantially. And so one of the things that we've asked is California, again, doing things backwards relative to property tax. We have taxing zoning districts that are set up to make viable timber management and agricultural management. They're called the Timber Production Zone and the Williamson Act, and you get a 90% tax reduction for managing your lands for the public trust benefits, or the benefits desired by the public for timber and agriculture. But California doesn't have anything for protecting the wildlife or the fish. There's no tax break for managing for long rotation timber, for instance, or for managing for forbearance of stream flows, which perpetuate that public trust resource, whether it's fisheries or whether it's wildlife.
Right.
And I think this is a conversation that we need to start having with the California legislature, with the tax assessors. By the way, anything that would modify the property tax values will get a lot of resistance from the assessors' associations and possibly counties, which means that you have to be very responsible when you try to address these issues, like, why are we disincentivizing people to put water tanks
mm-hmm.
on the ground? And so, I mean, we do have some proposals that are revenue neutral in California
uh-huh.
that take money, rob Peter to pay Paul, if you will, but take money, some of the gas tax money, take some of the other monies, and would direct them towards restoring some of these resources that have been affected by those. So I think that the short term is, I mean, we have to work with county supervisors to not disincentivize public trust upgrades and benefits. Long term, we need to take a look at how we're approaching things in California and come up with some new creative solutions.
Yeah. And oftentimes you find out that it needs to go to the state level, and that the counties don't have the power, or at least they don't think they have, and they direct you to the state.
Well,
do you find that as well?
Except you got to remember, we have Siskiyou County in our group, and I will tell you one thing they like to talk about is local power. I do think that when you talk about, particularly if you're going to talk about changing property tax, which is a state issue, but the only way you're going to do it is if you give the authority to make those changes to the local government. So, for instance, if Humboldt County wanted to include stream zones as a public trust benefit and allow people to zone stream zones for stream management, it would have to be something that the county would do through their general plan. They would update the general plan conservation element and say, these are the public resources that we want to allow tax breaks for, or tax incentives even. And it would be through that very general plan, same general plan process that Humboldt County and all the counties are going through. The public
uh-huh.
would have a chance to say, these are the resources we think are so valuable, we want to give tax breaks towards it. And that way you would build the support from your board of supervisors. It would be locally controlled, even though it would be a statewide process. And every county would have a say in how they would do it. So I could get into this too much.
This sounds fantastic. Are you running for office?
No. Never.
Well, maybe you could help advise. It's great how much research you've done on this kind of thing. Dana, any thoughts?
Well, it is a really tricky issue, and it's interesting to me your perception that in Trinity County people aren't being taxed for tanks. We've definitely heard a lot of reports from landowners that were taxed immediately, that it became on the radar screen of the county assessor. And it seems like there is some room for interpretation. As Tasha mentioned, one of the situations in Sonoma County was that if someone was creating an equal volume of storage, replacing storage, if someone was replacing an equal amount of storage or upgrading, but ideally having the same volume of storage, that they weren't going to be taxed. So we're really looking at, how to potentially incentivize on a county level. But I agree with Tasha that I think a lot of these changes are going to need to happen on a state level and really, have a paradigm shift among citizens and communities that will hopefully affect how this kind of thing is legislated.
So, Dana, I wanted to ask you also about what kinds of feedback you got, because you guys got a lot of great feedback from landowners about what kind of support they needed. I think you said some people could actually afford to get tanks, but they really needed help with the permitting and all kinds of other things. Could you speak to that?
Well, a lot of people have expressed that, I would say, close to half of the community, when you look at the landowner base, has expressed that they have invested in storage, and they did that on their own accord, recognizing a need. But what I think would really benefit the community is if there was some type of technical assistance, where people had assistance as far as understanding what the laws are, what the kind of taxation risks might be, what value it might be to them to file their water rights, whether it be a riparian right and or an appropriative right. So I think what people want is assistance navigating the process. The idea or concept of state water law, it's just really kind of hitting the ground here. A lot of people didn't even realize that these laws were on the books or that they directly pertain to them. So I think a combination of technical assistance, some legal, input or understanding the framework, and also understanding, what are the options available to them. And that's one of the things we're really exploring. Would lined ponds be, suitable? One of the things that came up for a lot of landowners, we did a water rights brochure that's available on our website at www.calsalmon.org, and also have a section, a water rights education section that has rural landowner questions to try to understand, state water law and how it pertains to them. And one of the big questions that came up is, well, what if I have a pond that's strictly fed by rainwater? And what I have heard and seen in writing is that is not something that someone would need to file an appropriative right for. So there are some existing workarounds, but I think the main thing that people really want to know is, how to install storage legally, how much storage do I need to get through the season, even just helping, understanding what people's water usage is. But usually when people make that initial investment and they invest in storage, you're really curious to see, well, how long does it take to fill this tank? How long does this tank last me? And people tend to, if they set up their own system, they are obviously invested in stewarding that system, and they are the people that are most knowledgeable about their micro watershed and their creek and flows. And something you said earlier, Mark, really struck me, the whole idea of, do people fundamentally understand the hydrology of wells and if their groundwater issues and so forth. And I think that one of the things that came up in our study is I suspect that there's some people that consider if there's a remaining wet spot in a creek that runs in the winter, that they are considering that a spring, that it's not necessarily how the water agencies regard springs. But if there's one kind of remaining hole that seeps in a creek, in a drainage. And I was wondering if you want to describe that, because I think for a lot of people, when they were even looking at the water rights and riparian rights, even some of the semantics were confusing for people.
Yeah, well, I guess this kind of brings us to the need for simplified permitting. And it was great because I get those guys' names mixed up. Matt Matranga?
Or do I have Mark Matranga and Matt McCarthy.
Matt McCarthy. Okay. So Matt McCarthy spoke to that. He saw a real need for that, that the forms are just not easy to fill out. We're talking about now filling out your riparian water right reporting, and also your if you need a small domestic registration, filling that out. And, I mean, we have a hard time at Sanctuary Forest. I've been working on this for 8 years now, filling these out and talking to our water law attorney, Robert Donlin, to get advice. And it's just some of the questions, you just can't figure out how to answer them. And then on the riparian that we were talking about, there's this whole thing about if it's a spring that doesn't flow off your property, then you don't have to report it on the riparian use forms. So there were things like this. Well, how do you define that not flowing off your property? And so, Mark, you were talking about earlier about some of these workshops that you're doing and this idea of getting people. I'm not sure if you said this tonight, but I know I've heard you talk about what are the good stewardship practices and what are best management practices. And what I'd love to see is a kind of simplified permitting for a bunch of things where if you just agree to do it according to these best management practices, then you just kind of get automatic processing, or not, maybe not automatic, but your permits are much more easily processed. Because it's just, I mean, some people just throw the papers down and just say, I can't do this. And, yeah, it's just intimidating. Anyway, what do you think about that?
Well, it's the opposite of the California approach. But I think it is where we need to go. I mean, I'm very cynical. California spends an inordinate amount of time writing regulations, which, when they finally get adopted, don't seem to change the outcome. So they set about writing more regulations because they're disappointed in the last round of regulations. And when you look around at best management practices, the thing you're talking about is the series of activities that can be taken to minimize the effects, and then making a programmatic permitting for that. Then what you're doing is you're focusing on how well did I do it? How can I do it a little better? Instead of being the regulator coming out there and like you said, filling out forms that many of us who have, you know, deal with this still struggle with, instead of that, you have a system that says, you know, if you crank this valve down a little bit more, you'll have the benefit that you need, and yet the creek will benefit, you know, focusing on water. I think it's a shift we need to make in the state. There's a problem in that a lot of people just don't trust other people, and so they think they'll abuse the best management practices. But what we have found in working with counties is, I like to say, it takes about 20 years to develop a bad habit, and it takes about 20 years to change a bad habit. But once you've changed it, it takes another 20 years for a new bad habit to form. So we kind of have to have this long perspective and training, and also we have to be willing to accept that we sometimes make mistakes, and these best management practices aren't intended to solve all the problems immediately. They're an education thing. I think Dana, you know, she hit it on the head. When people start becoming aware of what they're doing, they tend to jump past us with solutions. Once they begin to understand something, once they get invested in it, you know, people want to do the best they can. They just don't know how to do it, and they don't know how to go about it. So I'm a really big fan of us developing these best management practices and finding ways to get the agencies to have the faith in the people to try them, and then encouraging everyone to be patient and see if we can make a difference. I mean, we've certainly seen it with our best management practices on roads.
Great. The other thing that I want to just give a shout out to Jane Arnold, because we just did again, she's our local Department of Fish and Wildlife water rights person. And she, on a recent call, said that she just keeps on bringing that up. We need best management practices. And she keeps on bringing up the MTOL, PTEIR, which, are you familiar with that? That's for people that want to do sustainable timber harvesting on their land. And it's a way of, if you agree to doing it according to those practices, then you get this streamlined permitting.
I'm familiar with it.
Yeah. So it's great that we have somebody that has to deal with those regulations. I mean, that's the other part. Enforcing these regulations, and Department of Fish and Wildlife will come right out and tell you, they just don't have the manpower to do it. And it became really obvious this year that there were sometimes they would know about a problem where somebody was diverting from a stream that was drying up, and they couldn't even get out there for more than a month. So it's just, there's not, even if you like that regulatory approach, it's not working. It's not being effective.
And regardless of, you know, how confusing the intricacies of are of state water law and how it applies in a rural situation where people are dependent on the water source on their own land, I think it's really important to step back and look at the larger picture. Why was common law developed for managing water resources? And ultimately, I think it is important to start to quantify water usage. And there's some really huge decisions that we'll be making in California, the whole FERC relicensing process, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and looking at how in the Eel River, which is one of the largest watersheds in California, had the third strongest coho salmon population when it was one of the greatest fisheries. The Eel River Basin expands into six different counties, and it's over 300 square miles, the watershed. So when we look at a huge watershed like the Eel that is literally has as much sediment problems as the Ganges in India, when we look at that issue, and are thinking about how much water we send south, you know, I think it is important to get a handle on what are the real needs. And one of the things that I, you know, real needs on the North Coast. And I think one of the things that's interesting is that the Water Board has said that when people are filling out these forms, don't just think about what your current water usage is. Think about what your potential usage is. If you have potentially 20,000 gallons of storage, but you know that you are slowly and methodically moving towards 40 or 50,000 gallons, plan for that. And this is about our long-term water security and sustainability. And, you know, I think that people in the North Coast, rural landowners have a strong stewardship ethic, and they've had to learn how to steward their land. So it is a rewarding experience, you know, making the investment and then managing that investment. And this is kind of, you know, none of us like to, you know, pay our car insurance each year or, you know, renew our driver's license, but we do that for the luxury of driving. And, you know, basically we're fortunate to live in a place where we know where our water comes from, that we have, you know, clean water. And at the same time, we all have to face the reality that in the Eel River, we're in August in a situation where we have, you know, if you're a dog owner, you probably don't let your dog get into the river in August. You probably don't let your kids swim in late August. That we have a really impaired watershed, and it's beautiful, and certain seasons we see it, and it's flowing, and we're seeing the fish swimming and jumping, and, you know, later in the season we're seeing, can visibly see how much stress the Eel River is under.
Okay, well, I think we should open up the lines to anyone that has questions. So this is a Sanctuary Forest Radio Hour. You can call KMUD at 923-3911 and ask questions of myself, Tasha McKee, or Dana Stoltzman, or Mark Lancaster. And we'll just keep the discussion going here. So one thing that Dana and I have been talking about, Mark, is and Brian Johnson, he wasn't able to call in tonight from Trout Unlimited, but we've been working with him, is given that there's less grant dollars, should we be trying to provide more of this technical assistance to landowners, try to get grants, smaller grants, that make it so that we can provide this resource of this technical assistance and less trying to do capital on the ground projects? What do you think about that?
Well, I think that, so from the standpoint of providing that technical assistance, absolutely. People are, once you've done it, once you've got a track record, once the neighbors can say, yeah, I worked with this person, they were good, they were effective, you can't beat that. That's actually the most effective. But from the practicality of writing small grants and having to report small grants, the internal issues there are difficult. I think that sustainably we need actually the state to fund places like Sanctuary Forest.
Okay, and not have to be begging, going with our begging bowl every year. I think we've got a caller on the line. Caller?
Hello?
Are you there? Hello?
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Yes. What is the situation with those tanks? I think they're from Australia, that they collect the roof, rain on the roof, and fill a bladder tank inside.
Yes, okay, so the Australian tanks were bought by BlueScope, and now apparently, I think it's American Tank Company that bought BlueScope, so I think they're pretty expensive. I don't think they're the price. I know the price has gone up quite a bit, but you can find out about them through American Tank Company. And Dana, do you know more about the tanks that Mark and...
Well, I think those are also all Australian water tanks or the same.
No, they're grain tanks. They're similar, but they're grain tanks from the U.S.
So there are local providers that do assemble large-scale tanks like that that have a similar function and are about the same capacity of those Australian tanks. And actually, on our website, if you have access to the Internet on calsalmon.org, we actually have a brochure that we developed that outlines some storage options. And Sanctuary Forest also has done this wonderful water guide that I'm sure is available on their website.
So calsalmon.org?
Yeah, if you go to calsalmon.org and then under Redwood Creek Project, there's a brochure that has, you know, different tank options and kind of, you know, compares what the best value is per gallon. The Australian tanks, you know, are great tanks. Everyone I know who has them is really happy about them. If you install an Australian tank, you can pretty much bet that the county is going to notice. They're big and they require grading. I've heard that some people have even their tanks between the installation and the grading and the cost of the tank, that the county is valued at about a $50,000 investment. So even if you've spent less than that, you know, that is something to be aware of. But
what the county thinks,
Yeah, exactly, because you will probably, your property tax will probably increase if you install that. I'm a big fan of a tank farm, which is 5,000-gallon tanks, you know, a series of 5,000-gallon tanks.
A lot of those, yes.
And one of the benefits of those is, you know, if there was an accident, I mean, almost everybody I know has experienced a timer that didn't go off.
You don't dump it all.
Exactly. And that's something that you can slowly invest in, or if you don't have a big flash
flood. We got two more callers, I guess.
All right,
so.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for your call.
Bye.
Do we have somebody on the line? Hello?
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I got a question. I have a small piece of property, and the creek goes through the corner of my property. What do I have any rights to? What are my rights to that creek, or do I have any other than to just take care of it?
That is a wonderful question. Yes, it's wonderful. It's good if you want to take care of it. If it flows through your property, or even if your property line just joins it, then you have riparian water rights to that water body. And
What does that riparian mean?
Riparian water rights. So riparian water rights means that you can use water out of that stream for your beneficial use as long as you're not taking it all or impacting downstream users. You do have to file your use, though. And do you have those on your website, too, the diversion forms?
Yeah,
we
do. So I want to just really direct people there, because a lot of there's a lot of good resources here, and it was kind of specifically developed.
And we have two more colors.
So if people go to calsalmon.org under SRF Projects, Water Rights Education, there's the brochure there and a lot of questions and answers about, and, you know, links to the forms so people understand, you know, what constitutes a riparian right.
And if I can jump in really quick, although, if you have a riparian, if you have a water going across your property 99.99% of the time, you have a riparian right. Once in a blue moon, you don't, but that's so rare, we won't worry about it. What I do want to say, though, is if you're going to develop it, in my area, there is probably not a single stream that can afford yet another diversion out of it for the downstream beneficial uses of fisheries. So, if you do look to developing that, I really encourage people to use a trickle charge system where you take a half a gallon a minute, for instance, out of the stream system and put it into a tank. It can give you the water you need, and yet it has the minimal effect on the overall flow.
I think that's great, Mark. And that's something that Trout Unlimited's been doing down on some coastal streams, too, where pumping really slow or trickling into a small tank. So the idea is putting it into a smaller, like a 500-gallon tank, and then from there you'd pump to your bigger tank. Okay, we have another caller. Hello, you're on there?
Hello?
Are you?
Is
Hello?
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, I can't believe it.
You
okay,
made it. Happy Halloween.
I won't forget my question, but so you tank rather than pond.
You're breaking up a little bit. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah.
Can you hear me now?
Now we can hear you, yeah.
All right. Things I noticed you were saying earlier was about, I live at the top of a watershed, and the rainwater collection into a pond, for instance, with a liner, that does not have to be permitted. How is that possible?
Well, you need a grading permit to build the pond, But we're talking about, so there's, it's very complicated because there's all kinds of permits. We were talking about water rights. So the State Water Resources Control Board is the agency that deals with water rights. And if you're diverting water to storage or direct diversion, then out of a water body, then you need to have a water right and file with them. But if it's rainwater, that's why it's exempt. If it's rainwater falling into a pond.
Exactly. And I live at the top of the watershed, so all the hillside just flows into my pond. So that should be, why would they tax us on that? And what is the, why is that happening?
The taxes? Maybe you should, Mark, maybe you could answer that question. Why are they taxing us?
Why should we be getting taxed?
I think the answer is because they can. The assessor does not necessarily, first off, assessors aren't really thinking about the public trust resources.
Right.
You know, and so part of it starts there. There is a legitimate argument that there is a commercial agricultural component that is generating a lot of revenue. And to the degree that some of this activity is not for public trust resource, but for commercial endeavor, then, yeah, the tax system is set up for that.
Bummer. I just want a big pond to swim in. I figured this would be a good time to build it.
Well, if you're going to build a pond, for sure get some technical assistance because you can make a really big problem.
Yeah, no, thank you.
And then be in really big trouble and big fines, and then you won't feel good because you will have really harmed your land. So,
thank you for bringing that up. I believe it. I
think you're cutting out again. Do we have another caller? We have two more callers. So thank you so much for your call. I think we're going to move on to the next caller. Hello, caller?
Hey, is that me?
Yes, you're on the air.
Oh, I thought I was the second one. Anyway, hi, this is Jema.
Hi, Jema.
I want to just really appreciate you two water warriors being in there on Halloween.
Yeah.
I so appreciate your work.
Don't worry, we're dressed up.
Well, Sue is dressed up and so is Dana. I forgot to put on a costume. But
and I so appreciate the rain catcher tank that we got that I wanted to just at least make it easier for people that want to connect with that.
Good. Do you have the phone number?
Yeah, 986-7241.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you for
that. And those are the big metal ones. Those are the only big metal ones I've seen locally that do allow the rain to come through the roof, which I find a totally important feature.
Yeah. And I think they hold up to snow pretty well as also, which is another factor.
Oh, great. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, thanks so much for your call. I think we have another caller. Hello, caller.
Hi, Tasha, and hello, everybody out there.
Hi. Good evening.
First of all, just like JMS, thank you very much for internationally state-of-the-art work on stream restoration and water conservation and habitat restoration. We need a Smokey the Bear kind of poster campaign, and I hope we can find funding for it to educate people on the language and the numbers of the codes and the vocabulary of it in simple poster form. That can educate people gradually, like a comic strip.
Uh-huh.
And I hope that somebody will pursue that as an educational thing because there is a lot of lack of education. The other thing, my question is, we have a whole generation or three generations people vested in this restoration work. And then we have a whole other bunch of people who have moved in who don't care and are destroying. All the work has taken 35 years to build up, and everybody knows that the destruction of the environment through marijuana megagrows and is widely understood. Is there any group that's forming to help neighborhood watersheds and people who are participating in voluntary, watershed management, working together to keep vigilance on their creeks? And because usually what happens is there's one person on a watershed or on a road that will be known as the environmentalist, and then anytime anybody gets turned in for a violation, they point the finger at one person. And we need to see more people on every watershed participate in a vigilance of, to the stewardship of the land, so that when somebody gets in trouble for doing something terrible, it's understood that it's a community value. It's not just one snitch.
Yeah. Okay, well, good question. Let's see if we have any answers here.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. Mark, I'll throw it to you, but just briefly, I've thought that road associations might be the best avenue for that, because there are a lot of those already, and if they are taking on the stream as well, and you already have kind of a collective. But what are you guys doing up there?
Well, so I live in the middle of the woods. I'm the guy you shouldn't live in the middle of the woods. But just in the last 2 years, I've been completely surrounded by growers. And I went straight to each one of them, and I said, I'm about the last person in the world that you want to get on the bad side with, because I deal with marijuana grows and with all of the law enforcement people in California. So let's work together to address how you're doing your grow in our watersheds, so that we can not have problems, because if we have problems, you're not going to like it. And so I'm happy to be that snitch with any grower, in the sense that what we need is people who can be accountable to help them with, again, best management practices. People who are going to talk to them honestly and say, here's the limits of what you can do. So, for instance, one of the things that we try to get out here in the dry side, we try to get the word out. The farmers in the Central Valley of California know more about what's happening to the rainfall in Trinity County than the people in Trinity County. And they know that if it's a drought year, that they're going to have to change their crop rotation in the Central Valley because their water comes from Trinity County. But yet we see these growers that are totally oblivious to the climatic variation in our own community. So what we need to do is we need to get best management practices. We need to have honest discussions. We need to, my offer is to anyone in the five counties area that wants to put together a workshop with growers, and you know, we'll come and we'll talk about solutions. We'll talk about ways to do it. I think this is actually, it's a great opportunity here to say that, you know, we're just asking everybody to be responsible.
Great. Okay, well, we only have 2 minutes left, so I guess it's time to wrap this up. And Dana, do you have any closing remarks?
Well, I just wanted to say thanks for listening, and both the Sanctuary Forest and Salmonid Restoration Federation website have a lot of water resources. And one of the things that got Tasha and I talking a lot, and I think really responds to the last caller's question, is that the road associations really have been kind of the fundamental community building block and outreach tool. And a lot of road associations have come to us, and Tasha and I started talking about, you know, tributary associations, and I'm noticing that a lot of road associations are kind of looking at the larger landscape. And you know, there's a great sign along Lagunitas Creek that says it takes a village to raise a coho. And I think that neighbors really inspire each other. And I think when people, you know, start to do the right thing and start to really implement and practice water conservation, then, you know, others will, you know, people can lead by example. And I think we can really make a difference.
Great. Mark?
Well, I guess I'd like to say that the Matole and Redwood Creek are very small in the total watershed area, but they're so far advanced, and I think a lot of the things that you guys have done and are doing are going to be the models that are going to grow for the rest of us. And so we're all looking at what you guys are doing.
Well, thanks so much for your bigger view, too, though, of how we make this. That's really where we need to go, on a watershed scale across all these counties, to restore these fish and to have water security for people. So everybody, all our listeners, thank you so much. Thank you for the callers. Thank you to Sue for engineering. This has been a great discussion, and I'm really inspired about what more we can do with on the county and state level to help people help their watersheds. Good night. Happy Halloween.
River's not dying, no, she's being killed. We're sucking the water straight out of the hills. From monocropped ganja and grapes down below. Oh, it's clear Mr. Greed is still running the show. Yeah, it's